All right, hello everyone. So first of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about this kind of rather nifty new idea of using gas clouds as dark matter detectors. Before launching into the sticky details, I want to just acknowledge my collaborators, Amit and Joe are here. Fatma Alahi unfortunately isn't, but we shall persevere nonetheless. The work that I'm going to talk about is described in these two papers, so please, if this piques your interest, feel free to look those up for further details. The talk is also based on slides that Joe gave a few weeks ago, so thanks for the slides, and I will refrain from apologizing for mangling any concept until the end of the talk. Right, so when I made this, I kind of came to the conclusion that you definitely know that you've joined a astroparticle theory group when the first slide for your talk, and for the first time and possibly forever, isn't the ever so subtle reminder to the lovely galaxy simulation people that dark matter might have a sort of inner life that goes beyond a sort of self-gravitating, collisionless fluid that sort of has a mass resolution of a couple of tens of millions of solar masses. So I'm kind of delighted to be able to start off with something different. So this is from the lovely people at Xenon One Ton, and at least to me, this is sort of the sort of amalgamation or the sort of the accumulation of the sort of the field of dark matter searches, both on the theoretical and experimental side, in terms of what people have been working towards. So here we have the sort of classic kind of interaction curve, and so as things happen to be, the universe probably turns out to be more inscrutable than we perhaps hoped for. And so as we kind of start to explore this parameter space, people inevitably ask themselves the question, okay, so if we don't find exactly what we're looking for, or it's not turning up in the way we kind of hopefully initially expected, how do we go about expanding this parameter space? And so in particular, if you don't want to quite throw the theoretical baby out with the bathwater, you kind of consider the more conservative ways in which you can expand this parameter space. And so some of the kind of obvious questions to ask is, okay, so if I go lighter in terms of the mass range, what kind of problems do I run into? And so obviously for the lighter things, you get a problem trying to overcome the threshold, the detection threshold of these detectors. In the opposite direction, the more heavier your particle, the lower your number density, and so you reduce your flux and your incidence of potential cases of detection. And then if you go beyond this idea of like this WIMP or something weakly interacting, the moment you're talking about strong interaction, you have to worry about this idea of an overburden. So the idea is that in order for the particle to reach her detectors, it will undergo various scattering events. Worst case scenario, doesn't make it at all. Sort of intermediate case, it loses too much kinetic energy. And it, again, it isn't able to initiate a detection in one of these detectors. Right, so this is nothing new. This is not a like particularly novel insight. So people have been thinking about this and trying to figure out, okay, so how do we get around these? And so this is an example of some of these which address these questions. So in the top, we also have the ubiquitous CMB, which I reckon is the real MVP when it comes to frustrating aspirational model builders. But on the more self-made ways to test these things, some ways we can come around, like work around the limitations I've just spoken about, is by building experiments with lower thresholds, something like Sapphire, which is a calorimeter. Or we could do something very exciting, like launch rockets or balloons. That allows us to kind of reduce the lower the overburden. Also, these kind of things have minimal shielding compared to some other experiments. And so that's some of the ways we can kind of try to push beyond the sort of traditional bounds you get with direct detection experiments.
Is it really spectral distortions or angular anisotropies that are constraining?
Would that be model dependent? Right.
I thought it comes from anisotropies, not from spectral distortions.
Oh, perhaps I was being
Maybe that's my question.
Oh, right.
Am I right that all this slide is right? Yeah.
I will have to double check on it. Sorry about that. All right. So moving on from this, if we try to kind of combine some of the positive characteristics of these particular experiments, and try to come up some so some of the things we kind of keep in mind is that we're kind of limited in these kind of things. If we want to send something into space, we're to a certain degree still limited by the size of the thing. So I mean, as much as I would love Xenon 1 ton to be shot into space, I'm not quite sure how practical it is on a short-term scale. So if we kind of look at this picture where there's some good things and there's some not so good things, and so where do we go from this, and how do we kind of maximize the kind of characteristics of these to improve our detection bounds? All right, so I think the kind of obvious angle I'm going here for is this idea of astrophysical dark matter searches. And so this incorporates a kind of very wide and very creative range of searches, which I don't want to go into great detail, but I just want to kind of underline some of the kind of key facets of these searches. And so you can kind of think of these almost as like the flip side of terrestrial searches. And so the obvious advantages are that you're dealing with large scales and large objects. So you kind of, instead of worrying about, planet-sized things, you can start worrying about galaxy-sized things or filament-sized things, those kind of things. You can consider long exposure times, and similarly, you kind of get these extreme values of things like high densities or high energies. You've got to find a range of temperatures potentially in large amounts, or even like the chemistry of the material that you're looking for is far more exotic than something you could reproduce on Earth. Then the obvious disadvantages are that these environments are not controlled, and in some cases, we don't even fully understand these. And so similarly, you have to worry about strong backgrounds or foregrounds, trying to disentangle a potential dark matter signal from standard astrophysics, in particular in the case where, your dark matter might even mimic some of the astrophysics. And then lastly, of course, you've got observational limitations just because something is very far away or very long ago. And so these are the sort of things that you have to worry about. So there's a bit of a flip side of it. Okay, but this isn't going to deter us. So we're going to think, okay, so we've got dark matter detectors, but now we're going to do dark matter detectors, but in space, which I think sounds like a good title for a movie. Anyway, so before we kind of launch into our little project, I feel like we have to pay homage to one of Perimeter's residents and talk about sort of something about where the inspiration for this came from. So this goes all the way back to 1990. And so if we want to look for something like a calorimeter in space, the obvious place to go perhaps is the interstellar medium. And so if we consider the interstellar medium, it's dominated by hydrogen. And so while hydrogen itself is a relatively simple system, the different gas phases it forms is very much sort of non-trivial. And so early on, people identified this cold, neutral, dense phase as well as this hot ionized phase. And intermittently, we've kind of identified even further phases, ranging from very cold molecular gas all the way to this very hot plasma. But in this case, we're going to look at the cold gas that you find in the ISM. And so the observation is relatively simple, which allows these bounds to be set. And so the idea is that if we consider cold gas, if we compare the gas which is embedded in the dark matter halo in which our Milky Way is situated, then the temperature of the dark matter particles is greater than that of the gas. And so if you have some sort of nucleon interaction between the dark matter and the gas, you actually end up having a net heating effect on the gas. And so the assumption that we make is that considering this phase is stable, there's some form of thermal equilibrium. And so if we can then figure out what the cooling rate is of this gas, then we can, and assume that it stays at this temperature, we can then set bounds on the heating from the dark matter. And so luckily for us, along with our observations of the ISM, come observations of these cooling lines from this hyperfine states. And so through direct observations, we actually know what the cooling rate of this gas is. And then just by simply kind of comparing these, we can set bounds on interactions. And so, right, so there's two ways you can figure out, oh, you mean the cooling mechanism itself, or?
Yeah, how do you figure out that this is the main cooling mechanism?
Right, so I'm going to talk a little bit more about cooling of cold gas later on, but just to kind of skip ahead a little bit. So the thing, cooling of gas is solely dependent on the chemical composition and then the temperature of the gas. And so if we kind of have a fairly robust model of what the species of the gas, in particular this medium, is, so when we talk about this cold phase of the interstellar medium, there are certain assumptions about pressure equilibrium and so on and so forth. We can then make certain assumptions with enrichment from stars, what kind of metallicity we expect. So we have a fairly good appreciation of what the chemical composition is. And then we know that different species contribute to coolings through these hyperfine transitions. And so at different temperatures, different species dominate. And so in this particular temperature range, where we're thinking something 30 to 80 Kelvin, it just happens to be this particular carbon line because it's the one that's most easily excited. And so we in this case, it's actually nice because we have direct observations of this emission, but we also, and it also matches just purely modeling of the gas at that temperature and that density. So it's a topic that's fairly well understood. It's there's a few subtleties I'll talk about later on. But yeah, so the cooling rate is not so much of an issue here. Okay, so that's kind of a nice start, but since we're physicists, we're never satisfied with anything, and so we want to figure out how do we improve this even further. And I think the obvious question to that is move everything to the galactic center. And so this is not showing up at all, unfortunately. If hypothetically, if you could see this is a physicist's impression of an artist's impression of the Milky Way. So here is our dark matter halo. It looks like a uniform blob. In reality, there was some gradient on there to indicate our nice NFW profile. Here's the Earth. There was a disk there, and then there was a central bulge. So the kind of motivation to then, I mean, obviously, like I mentioned before, we can't physically pick up a gas cloud and move it to the galactic center, but there are good reasons to consider looking at the galactic center if we can't find some analog to the ISM calculation. And so the reason to go there is the first one is obviously you've got greater dark matter density, which is always a nice thing, but more importantly, we're looking for cold gas, and so I talk a little bit more about the sort of very basic idea of galaxy formation later on, but cold gas is often associated with star formation. So you've got higher rates of star formation at the galactic center. So it kind of is a reasonable assumption to make that, okay, so maybe we'll have greater supplies of cold gas there as well. So two of the things we definitely need to do this calculation, live in the galactic center. Now to you know, be suitably pessimistic or realistic about this, we have to acknowledge the messy astrophysics, which kind of is ubiquitous in the universe, and the even messier astrophysics at the galactic center. And now here, this actually has a sort of flip side insofar as, like, yes, there are a whole bunch of other things which we might have to worry about when we're setting these bounds, but at the same time, messy astrophysics means that there are lots of astrophysicists interested in figuring out what's going on. And so we might be able to, you know, latch on to some unsuspecting astronomer's survey of the central region when they try to figure out all of this vaguely labeled messy astrophysics. And maybe through that way, we'll be able to find a suitable calorimeter with which to set dark matter bounds. Okay, and now I'm going to kind of make this sort of weird detour where I talk about H1 surveys. So when it comes to galaxy formation, the importance of the gas can't be understated. So in order to form a galaxy or to grow a galaxy, you need a continued inflow of gas. You have to be able to cool it. In the process of forming stars and galaxies, this gas can also be expelled and recycled. And so trying to figure out what the distribution of gas is in the galaxy is quintessential to figuring how galaxy formation works. And so this is why lots of people look at, try to conduct these surveys just to try to figure out what the distribution of this atomic hydrogen near the galactic center is. And so the key way to do this is via the 21 centimeter line. And so this particular refers to this hyperfine spin flip transition at a vacuum. It corresponds to 21 centimeters, therefore the name. And it's, like I said, it's key in observing atomic hydrogen. And so this is another thing where the kind of the names of things are somewhat odd. So the particular observable is the spin temperature. It's not really a temperature in the traditional sense. It's more of a brightness temperature. But it relates more to the kind of the relative occupation of this the spin flip transition. Moreover, it's set by coupling to the surrounding radiation and gas fields. And so key to these are the CMB, or in the case where you get closer to stellar sources, whatever radiation background is established there. And then through the Woodhouse and Field pumping effect, you can also couple this to the gas temperature and the color temperature. In this case, you can think of the color temperature as being somewhat analogous to the gas temperature. So the thing to take away if you then try to, you know, write down this observable, is that by observing this particular 21 centimeter signal, you can get information about the temperature of the gas, but moreover the density of the gas, as well as the ionization fraction of the gas. And so you can extract a lot of information by doing these 21 centimeter surveys. And so luckily for us, one particular I want to talk about is the ATCA, the Australian Telescope Compact Array H1 Galactic Center Survey, conducted by McClure Griffiths et al. And so you can kind of see this is sort of an overview of their Galactic Center Survey, which is all very interesting. But more importantly, besides this kind of continuous structure, they also found these discrete gas clouds. And so here is an example of one of the kind of brightness magnitude measurements. You know, if you consider the velocity, the line width of these, you can extract a whole bunch of information about the physical properties of the clouds. And so what they found is this, so up here is their data. They found this whole suite of compact objects ranging from a couple of tens of degrees up to a couple of thousands. And they are fairly large, and more interesting, they all seem to be moving outwards in this sort of like shell-like formation from the galactic center. And here underneath is them trying to reproduce the motion of these gas clouds. And so these are nice candidates for potentially detecting dark matter. So I kind of mentioned before that in order to do these calculations, you have to worry about the gas physics. And so the gas physics is going to be somewhat dependent on the environment these clouds are. So these are clearly not just hanging out in this particular area of the galaxy. There's some sort of motion associated with these. So I thought I'd explain a little bit about why these are there and why this is interesting. So as I mentioned before, in order to kind of understand galaxy formation, you have to understand how gas inflows, gas cools, and as gas is expelled from these. And so within the galactic center in particular, once you have a sufficiently large supply of cold gas, it will continue cooling until eventually compacting until it's eventually dense enough to form stars. But then in return, the formation or these kind of intense starbursty areas, which the Milky Way probably underwent maybe 10 or 20 million years ago, produces these galactic winds. And so these actually are these very energetic events in which this sort of very hot diffuse medium gets expelled from the star forming region. And as it kind of maps out these kind of lobes heading out into the disk and the halo, it kind of picks up the kind of remaining gas around the star-forming regions and entrains these. And so these are the kind of clouds that are observed in the McClure-Griffiths survey. So this is where we're at. We basically now have some nice cold gas clouds there, which have been pushed out of the galactic center by the galactic winds most likely produced from star formation.
How do you know if they are making a start or they're falling in?
Oh, we measured, like, the survey tells you the velocity of the clouds moving out.
Well, but I mean, if the velocity, if it's behind, I mean, it's farther from Alexander, it could be moving out, it's closer, it could be moving out. I mean, that doesn't tell you whether it's falling in or falling out.
So the if you look at the 21 cent, it will give you a direction.
The 21 centimeter?
Yeah, from the galactics.
You just have line of sight velocity, right?
Yes, but it still gives you the.
He's saying that you need to know additionally if it's behind the center or in front of the center.
Yeah. I think having simulations and trying to infer an overall flow, we don't really know
that. I mean, hypothetically, I mean, I concede that, I mean, they could be falling in, but considering what we know about what we expect the dynamics of the galactic center, so AGN feedback, stellar winds, and stellar feedback to be, I can't quite think of a physical mechanism which would produce that bulk motion inwards. So maybe there's a stray cloud which is kind of going in the opposite direction, but it would be very unlikely
It is confusing that there isn't really much of active. There isn't much of star. I mean, Milky Way is not actively star forming.
No, this was location. So. This is not. So these clouds aren't like just now accelerated. So this happened maybe 10 million years ago, when people did expect there was a starburst. And so these have been traveling for a significant period of time. So these are being actively expelled. So these have been traveling for a while.
Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the other way. We can pretty much infer these must be coming from the galactic center because you just wouldn't have formed this number of clouds outside of it.
Yeah, so the other thing to, which I haven't mentioned is they don't just sit in the disk. In some cases, they actually elevated quite a little bit above the disk.
But I mean, if you look up there, there's a cosmological gas inflow.
Oh, right. So there's a, okay, so I should, okay, I'm going to want to. So there's a difference between these large cosmological inflows and these small discrete clouds. So these kind of streams, you would get those from filamentary structure or potentially, I mean, you know, you might even get through mergers or just the CGM. And so the way, so the think about this, from the circumgalactic medium, this accretes onto the halo. So it will have to undergo shocks first. So shock heating. There is somewhat of a debate whether there's hot accretion or cold accretion going on, but even in surveys, this gas looks very different than the actual clouds. And I've actually got a picture some of these clouds, so you can kind of see some of these highlighted there. And this is very different than the cosmic gas infalling, than this kind of these smaller structures being expelled from the center.
Yeah. Well, maybe I guess I'm not convinced. I think people can draw different cartoons or pictures for why they think is happening, but as far as I can tell, it could be either.
Okay, right. Luckily for us, I think either or would still allow us to draw conclusions about our dark matter bounds. So I think we should be okay even in a case where all the astrophysicists are wrong. Okay. These are the ultimately the three clouds we picked off our survey. I actually looked up the proper collective noun for clouds, and it is a soufflé. It also, Wikipedia tells me it's a nucleus of physicists. So there we go, I learned something anyway. Okay, so these are the three clouds that we're looking at. So just to give you kind of a rough idea about what the physical parameters of these are, they are between like a tens and hundreds of solar masses. So they're considerable in size. The radius is a couple of tens of parsecs. We're assuming spherical symmetry here. In reality, there'll be some sort of filamentary feathery kind of structure, but you know, for now we're going to stick with that. So the density is somewhat lower than what you expect from the cold ISM phase. Here are the temperatures. So these two, couple of hundred. This one is 22. There is a kind of caveat attached to this particular one, insofar that the observation. This kind of temperature is right at the edge of where we sort of trust our observations of these clouds. So there's a chance that this is actually a fluctuation rather than a genuine temperature. But we've included it nonetheless because I think it's short of having follow-on observations, I think it's believable enough. And if not, I think it just goes to show why other surveys of hydrogen gas could be motivated to look for these very cold objects for the sake of dark matter bounds. All right, and so here are the velocities from which they're traveling. All right, and here's one particular picture from the survey. I don't think these necessarily correspond to our clouds, but just as a sort of demonstration about what kind of these objects look like. Okay, so that's a good start. So how do we then turn these into calorimeters, and how do we send dark matter bounds with these? Okay. Okay, well, never mind. So the kind of key ingredients. So one of the things, if you could read this, is said this is that the heating and cooling is dependent on the environment. So that's perhaps one of the kind of trickiest things about this, is that we have to worry about where is this cloud situated and how does this impact our cooling and heating. Then we've got the cooling, which is the gas physics, and as I said before, it can be fairly complex, but it's very well understood. We've got heating from dark matter. I mean, in this case, I've mainly talked about heating. However, in certain parameter spaces, you can actually cool gas as well. And then lastly, we've got this additional heating from canonical astrophysical sources, and that's perhaps the least well understood on these. So this can includes a whole range of backgrounds and processes, and these are far much harder to constrain than the dark matter and the cooling. And then, of course, we've got observations from 21 centimeters.
There are some dark fonts in there.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. I
tell us what they say.
Oh, so this basically says heating and cooling is dependent on the environment of the clouds, just because the environment will influence what your heating source is. And similarly, the heating will have an impact on the gas physics and the gas chemistry. And then similarly, different places in the halo will have different, your dark matter will have different kinematic properties. So all of this kind of feeds into these, and there's some sort of, there can be potentially some kind of complex interaction between these things. So let's try to disentangle them for now and start off with cooling. So as I kind of mentioned before, the cooling can be a fairly complex topic, but luckily it's relatively well understood. So the key things to keep in mind is that the cooling of gas is dependent on the temperature, on the density, and the chemical composition of gas. And so here, for Meyer et al., we kind of see this kind of this cooling rate or this cooling curve across a whole range of temperatures. At these very high, 10 to the 8 Kelvin, cooling is predominantly facilitated by Bremsstrahlung. Then this kind of regime over here, you can see all these little bumps, and these come from the different dominant species. So you'll have carbon and oxygen and iron. And so you kind of get electrons either exciting or ionizing these species. And then you have, and that's how you lose energy there. And this is why this is so bumpy. It's like different species will be more dominant at different temperatures. And then these different curves correspond to different metallicities. So if you've got more or fewer metals, your cooling will be different. Then as you kind of hit this kind of critical point over here, this last peak actually corresponds to cooling from hydrogen. So this kind of collisional ionization. And at this point, and this is where we kind of get into the regime of using cold gas clouds as dark matter detectors, you can see you have this massive drop in the heating efficiency. And this is because the kind of direct collisional ionization and excitation processes become inefficient. And so in this regime over here, which is where our gas clouds are situated, you basically have two main cooling mechanisms. The one that we're most interested in is facilitated by the hyperfine transitions of metals. And I should mention at this point, when I say metals, I mean in the astrophysical sense, and so for everything heavier than helium is a metal. So carbon, oxygen, neon, everything's a metal. I didn't make it up, but it's one of those kind of historical quirks. And you can kind of see over here, the changing the metallicity can have significant impact on the efficiency of your cooling curve. The other way in which you can cool gas is via molecules, so molecular hydrogen, gas, CO. Those become more interesting once you go very much below maybe 10 Kelvin, or alternatively, if you have very, very high, like very, very dense gas. And so neither of these are really applicable to the gas clouds at hand, but I thought I'd mention it in case we happen to find some other very cold, dense gas clouds where this becomes relevant.
So even though, I would imagine molecular hydrogen, you have much more of let's say carbon, things like that. So, I mean, I know in molecular hydrogen is tricky because it's homonuclear,
mm-hmm.
so the efficiency of cooling is not
mm-hmm.
as good. But if you can have hydrogen and heteron molecules, and those are more efficient. So, but you're saying that even so, the time that the metals are still more efficient.
Yes, that's what we find.
Deuterium is more rare.
It is.
Yeah,
for
10 minus 5. Deuterium is 10 minus 5.
Yeah, but
all of
your lithium is 10 minus 5.
Oxygen is 10 minus 3.
Ah.
Yeah.
I see.
And so this is the other thing that kind of comes into this, is that forming enough molecular hydrogen can be challenging, because they don't readily form collisionally. And so if you have gas which is more maybe like 10 to the minus 1, maybe 1, maybe 10 nuclei pi r per centimeter cubed, and then just forming the molecular hydrogen, and then also once you have like a stellar background, it's very easy to dissociate these things again. So like I said, once you get down to very, very cold temperatures, it starts becoming important again, and also if you've got very dense gas. So the key thing is that metals are very important in terms of setting the cooling efficiency of gas. And so I thought I'd talk a little bit about the metallicity. So as I mentioned, this basically comes from the enrichment from the stellar cycle. So massive stars exploding enriches the gas. Like I said, the cooling is very sensitive to the metallicity of your gas. And so we have to worry about some of the uncertainties about how do we figure out what the metallicity of the gas. And so there's the obvious observational challenges associated with this. There's a question of how the gas mixes, or how the metals are mixed into the galactic ISM. And then there's this other kind of thing where the ISM, or the gas, doesn't just contain the usual atomic and molecular species. It also contains these dusts and grain components. And so these are either silica-based or carbonaceous. And it's an ongoing field in its own right. But the important thing is that you can have depletion of metals into these dust and into this dust grain component. And so you can lose some of these critical cooling species by having them trapped in dust. And similarly, like the presence of the dust and grain can act as a shielding kind of presence to radiation fields, and also obscure observations. So this kind of dust grain treatment can potentially be tricky. But just to kind of demonstrate one of the sort of general trends. So this is the metallicity of the Milky Way at different heights. And so you can kind of see that there is not just a radial dependent, but there's also a metallicity dependent with height. So we can kind of see that the area close to the galactic center tend to be more metal rich, which makes sense because you've got higher star formation rates. Okay, so that's the metallicity. Perhaps the last thing to say on that is that err on the side of caution. Then I thought I'd talk a little about the heating. And so this is far less well constrained than the cooling. So you can have heating from photoelectric effects from grain, or just simple ionization. You've got the ubiquitous UV background. You've got X-rays, cosmic rays, then the usual magneto and hydrodynamic heating, as well as things like interstellar shocks. And so here from Wolfire, you can kind of see a comparison. So this is a particular gas at different densities. And you can kind of see the different processes. So the dotted lines are cooling processes. So here the dotted lines are heating processes. So here we have the photoelectric effects. And here we have X-rays and cosmic rays. And these solid lines are the cooling rates I've described before. So you can kind of see here is carbon. There's oxygen recombination. The Lyman alpha is associated with hydrogen processes. So that's the heating. And lastly, once you kind of have an appreciation of what's in your gas, you kind of want to figure out the chemical network. And so, as I mentioned before, these different species in the gas, so the different ionized species and the different metals and the different atoms contribute to the cooling. And so to figure out precisely how much of each of these you have to solve this kind of rather complicated chemical network. And so here's all the different reactions you have to worry about if you're just worrying about hydrogen and helium. And so this becomes, you know, even more complicated once you add the other metals in. And so to keep in mind processes such as photo and collisional ionization, recombination, and so on and so forth, they will drive some of these reactions one way or the other just because you've got an additional radiation field. And so luckily for us, there are a whole bunch of like very nice codes which kind of deal with calculating this. We used a code called Cloudy. And that allows you to set up the physical a physical spherical cloud which matches the properties that were observed by the Australian survey. It allows you to give it a certain to vary the metallicity. It allows you to play around with grain models, set UV or cosmic ray rates, and then it will calculate the appropriate chemical network for that particular cloud. And so you can kind of see these are the different kind of parameters we considered. And this is the output for the 137 Kelvin cloud. Over here, so this is the depth into the cloud. Over here, you can see the cooling rate. And so I think the thing to kind of keep in mind is that at the edge of the cloud, the radiation background penetrates far enough to heavily influence or heavily impact the gas chemistry of the cloud. But then eventually, you kind of get the sort of shielding effect, and you kind of set up a sort of this more stable environment at the center. You can kind of calculate the temperature. And then here we can calculate the electron density of these various objects. And so you can kind of see just from here, the different colors correspond to different models. And in particular, in this case, these correspond to different metallicities. So this one is solar metallicity. This one is above solar. This one is below. And so you can kind of see that metals don't just contribute to the cooling. They also contribute to the free electron density. And that turns out to be important later on, because we're going to be considering dark matter interactions with these electrons. All right, so that's a nice way to kind of deal with all of this stuff consistently. And then lastly, I should make a comment about the dark matter halo model. So obviously, when you kind of place your dark matter calorimeter somewhere within the galactic halo, the density is going to vary with radius. And so our gas clouds sit sort of around over here. You can, luckily for us, they're far enough away from the galactic center that we don't have to quite delve into the quagmire that is debating how cuspy or corey or Milky Way is. So
you're going to assume a large cross-section on variance on dark matter that probably will flatten the profile central profile anyway. Because there is as much variance there as dark matter.
Yeah, central
it's not an issue.
But I guess the thing is that these are very cold clouds, so I guess maybe it doesn't take that much scattering to heat them up. So I think this is flattening the whole dark matter up, that requires probably much more, I imagine, scattering than just heating up a tiny cloud.
So you think you can be below the threshold?
That's my feeling. I mean, I guess that's probably that's why you're looking at them, because they are very cold and sensitive.
Well, I mean,
in any case, you still have to take the worst case scenario for the profile, right? So you have to make the bait the bound for
sure.
The fat profile. If you were using NFW to get a constraint, then that wouldn't be much of a constraint.
So I should mention that this very, very conservative. But it's just a very, this is just a very naive, if I throw something with the mass of the Milky Way at a standard Burkitt profile with the mass concentration parameter that's expected for something of this size. So this hasn't been fitted to fit Milky Way data. So these are the ones you probably want to look at. And in the range where we're at, there's not, if we were closer to the galactic center, I completely agree, making sure that the halos we form is consistent with the dark matter model we're investigating. But I think we're at a radius where we don't have to worry about that to the degree where we would if we were right in the center. But yeah, figuring out how, if you have these interactions with the baryons, how these self-consistency produce halos is an important question. And Yeah, all right, not to go into that any further.
Can I ask you something? So is this cold clouds, do you only see them near the center of Milky Way, you don't see them farther away?
So you find cold gas in throughout all the branches of the Milky Way. So you find them out in the disk as well, and so on and so forth. So yeah, like I said, this kind of cold gas isn't unique to that particular location. The nice thing about that is that we do have a discrete object. So in the case where it's further out, it might be far more diffuse or far more sort of like a continuous. And like I said, the other thing is having it closer to the galactic center means you've got a larger dark matter background.
But it's a larger uncertainty in dark matter.
Yeah, but like I said, it's... It's a sort of trade-off you have when you do this. All right. So these are certainly things you have to worry about, and you have to be upfront about it. Okay. All right. So setting bounds. So now that we've got all our ingredients, we've got a suitable calorimeter, we have an understanding of how this thing cools down, we have an understanding of how this thing heats up. We kind of have an appreciation about how robust our limits are depending on where we place our gas cloud. Now we kind of actually want to get to the point and get some actual dark matter interactions into this thing. So we kind of consider not...
Sorry, can I ask, what about, you're assuming that the cloud is in thermal equilibrium. Is that an important assumption?
I'm getting onto that right now.
Yeah.
So one of the really, I'm just going to skip ahead anyway. So one of the really neat things is that this particular method doesn't require this. I mean, in some cases, it does require thermal equilibrium, but for the bounds that we are setting, we can actually get around that to a certain degree. And I'll explain that in the next two slides. And that's one of the great advantages of doing, you know, physics with these very, very cold gas clouds. All right, so we consider different classes of bounds depending on what your dark matter is doing and different assumptions. So let's start with this one where we just assume our dark matter interacts just with either the electrons or the metal. So we've got our heating coming in from the dark matter. Our 21 centimeter observation tells us the temperature and therefore the cooling rate. Not just the temperature, we also get the density and so on for. So we infer our cooling rate. And so we can set a bound by assuming the dark matter heating is less than the radiative cooling. And so we don't require thermal equilibrium for reasons I will explain now. So one of the key things to observe about this dark matter cloud is that they're old. So the assumption is that they're at least 10 million years old, just because they must have, like, in order for them to travel from their original location in the star forming regions out to where we observe them, they've been kind of these objects for a lengthy period of time. The other thing to keep in mind is that these cooling curves for a fixed density and a fixed metallicity are monotonically decreasing, which means that if we observe something at a certain temperature, we can set an upper limit to the cooling efficiency. And so we can then given that these objects are of a certain age, we can then draw the conclusion that, well, if we kind of set this upper limit to cooling, we can then subsequently assume that any potential heating from dark matter must be below this rate in order for us to observe the cloud at the temperature that we do. So does that follow? Right. And the other kind of neat thing about this is that by just classifying that we're just interacting with either the electrons or the metals, we know that the cooling is dominated, so the cooling rate is driven by how many of these metals we have. We're just interacting with this, and so we kind of get this cancellation where the kind of we kind of the our dependence on the total metallicity rate of the gas sort of gets washed out, and so there's one kind of astrophysical uncertainty we have to worry about. One less of these uncertainties we have to worry about by just restricting our dark matter interactions with electrons and metals. All right, so that's a sort of class, or what we like to call the class one bound. Then we can complicate this. Oops. Can we? Oh yeah, so no eclipse. We can extend this to a class two and have changed from Roman to Latin numerals, typical. All right, so now we kind of include the interaction with non-metals. So the same argument in terms of the cooling and the non-equilibrium condition applies, except this case we have to be more sensitive to what the metallicity of our cloud actually is. And so in both of these cases, oops, there we go. sorry about that, I will always advocate setting conservative bounds. And so, for example, I talked about the clouds originating from the galactic center. And so if we look at surveys of the metallicities found there, we want to kind of consider the higher metallicities that are observed, because that will give us a higher efficiency of heating, cooling, sorry about that, that's a typo. And so that will help us set conservative bounds. The other thing we can do is that at this point, I only talked about the dark matter heating. In reality, you've got additional UV, the cosmic rays and the grains. But conservatively, we can say, okay, so we just assume all the heating just comes from dark matter heating. If you have a very good grasp on the environment of your cloud and you know exactly how, if you don't have to worry about shielding from the UV, you know exactly what your grain composition is, then you can certainly include those and improve your bounds. But like I said, it can be challenging to determine these. And so something, especially if you have like the cosmic ray background, you can have, if you consider the sort of average ionization rate of this, depending on your line of sight, those can vary up to an order of magnitude. And considering that these cosmic rays are kind of critical or they can be very important in terms of setting your chemical network. So, and that's also your electron fraction. You'd have to find a fairly unique case where you can confidently say you know exactly what all of these are. So if you want to kind of set conservative bounds, assume high metallicities or the highest reasonable metallicities, and just restrict yourself to dark matter heating. Okay, so lastly, and this is a sort of other thing, and this kind of also falls into the category of theoretically possible, perhaps not advisable, is this kind of case where you have dark matter not heating your gas, you have it cooling your gas. And so in this case, you can't make that assumption or the non-equilibrium assumption. You actually have to match these various rates completely. So in this case, you've got cooling from dark matter, you've got your radiative cooling, and you have to match it with the heating from the astrophysical sources. And as I've just discussed, that's extremely challenging. And in particular, close to the galactic center, that would be a very kind of, I'm not quite sure how robust you could define those in those environments. So this is something that's certainly possible, but you have to think very, very hard about how well you can constrain these. Okay, so that's all the theoretical jargon out of the way. So now I think I might actually show some plots relating to dark matter. So we considered a whole range of different sort of dark matter classes, all of which would potentially be suitable to be detected using these gas cloud calorimeters. So we thought we'd start off with this ultralight dark photon. So from my understanding is you augment your kind of standard model with an additional U1 field. The ultimate, the particle that sort of falls out of that is a suitable dark matter candidate, provided it has a mass. So the kind of neat thing is that as it couples to the standard model field, it produces this oscillating electric field. And so please refer to this reference for more details. And so if you place then one of these cold gas clouds within this oscillating field, the free electrons and ions will be accelerated. And so the motion of these will then imbue energy into the gas and heat the gas up. And so we kind of treating our cloud as this very kind of diffuse plasma. And here we have the kind of plasma frequency. And from that, you can work out the heating rate. And so if you actually turn this into a plot, we can kind of see bounds over here. So here's the ISM calculation. Here are our different clouds. And so this is the very cold cloud. So the reason that one gives the best or the bounds work differently is because they are progressively colder, but they're also less dense. So so they're diffuse and they're cold. And so this is how you get these strong results. Okay.
So there is a decoupling at the small amounts.
Sorry?
There is a decoupling at small amounts of the dark matter, right?
It's there. It's there. That's why it's going up. The constraint gets worse. Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense.
Okay. So the next class is we can consider vector portal dark matter. And so in this case, the dark matter isn't the particle interacting with our gas clouds. We're considering this mediator instead. Here the dark photon is this particular mediator. So in both of these cases, these are both class one bound. So in this case, we're just considering interactions with the electrons and the ions. So we can consider different mass ranges of this mediator. On terrestrial detectors, these are challenging to detect just because they're too slow to overcome the detection threshold. But luckily for us, our dark matter clouds will pick them up. So here is for an extremely light mediator. So from here are our gas clouds. And so we kind of map out a new part of the perimeter space over here. From what I understand, in case people are interested, so this covers a similar perimeter space than the kind of milli-charged models proposed to explain the potentially unusual edges results, depending on which side of the astroparticle divide you land. Either the results are not to be trusted, or it's the perfect reason to dig out your favorite dark matter models to explain reionization. But we can cover that parameter space as well. Luckily for us, it looks like we...
But does the thing go? So there's the xenon constraint that comes in. There's the supernova bound.
Mm-hmm. This is the one
that goes. Oh no! What is the line? There's this line. The supernova bound is the thing that sticks like a knife, right?
This thing.
So, but there is this line that comes up from in the left side of the plot. It starts from 10^-22, a bit below, and then it goes up.
This one over here.
Yeah. What
is that?
That's
a CMB. It's another CMB restraint constraint.
Okay.
So these are all in overlapping regions. This is what I want to see. So is there a part where this is not constrained by something else?
This over here.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
This is
so we figured out a way. Yeah, it's
In your plot it shows better. I can see the computer.
Oh right. Yeah, I'm sorry. I have no talent when it comes to making slides.
No, the projector is horrible.
Okay. So we can play the same game for a medium sized mediator and for heavy mediator. And so I think in this regime you can kind of see more clearly that we're mapping out sort of untouched parameter space. All right. And then lastly,
Are you assuming that the dark matter is thermal or anything, or are you just assuming there's some production mechanism within?
At this point, I have to confess that I'm somewhat agnostic on the details of the dark matter
production. That's fine. There's no constraint about the production mechanism. You're just saying, oh, there's dark matter, it was produced this way somehow, and then it has this mediator.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I think it's a sort of trade-off between trying to define the most general classes and trying to actually constrain specific models. All right, so lastly, we'll kind of move one from the class one bound to a class two bound. And so we actually consider interactions between dark matter and nucleons. And so things like this could be like some sort of strongly interacting composite or super heavy dark matter. So there are two things we kind of want to consider there when setting these bounds. So we start to have to worry about against this potential overburden from the clouds. So we kind of want to make sure that when we're heating these objects, we're heating them uniformly. In case if you have something that's too strongly interacting, you only kind of reach the edges of the cloud. And then if you could potentially have this kind of effect where you actually you're evaporating, the cloud rather than heating the entire object. And considering that these bounds are somewhat dependent on our objects being stable, we kind of want to make sure that we do kind of provide this kind of uniform heating. So that's one thing to worry about. And similarly, we kind of worry about when we get, again, too large masses. If your dark matter becomes too big, then eventually the kind of comparable size between the cross sections and the dark matter cloud kind of breaks down, and so you kind of run into limits there. So here we can kind of see the bounds for these kind of nucleon scattering cross sections.
Can you have such a large cross section? Such a large element? Is it like theoretically attainable?
Oh, right. I am told on good authority that there is some model building in this parameter space. So this is these are some very like extreme composite models.
So it's like a blob.
Yeah, it's a nugget. I think is the preferred word. Yeah. So there is model building going on. It's somewhat more exotic than your usual WIMP or whatever else you want to throw at these things. But apparently that's going on. All right. So I think that kind of brings us to the end of this sort of journey into galactic calorimeters. So just to summarize, there's this kind of growing community of people looking for to extending dark matter searches to astrophysical objects. And they obviously provide very valuable testing grounds just because they give us access to scales or chemical properties or just like locations which we can't access. In terrestrial detectors, there's the usual caveat that yes, they have these exciting qualities, but at the same time, the astrophysical backgrounds and environments remain crucial for us to understand these and model these carefully in order to set robust bounds. And then lastly, just to summarize, these cold galactic center gas cloud can act as very useful dark matter detectors for a range of dark matter models and can set new bounds for these particular classes. So thanks for your attention, and I'll take any questions.
So Glennis's objection was what, and how did you?
All right. So okay. So we will now make a perhaps ill-informed journey into the details of entrainment. So I briefly touched on this idea that from our understanding is that the gas clouds we observed originated from these star-forming regions in the galactic center, and then due to the galactic winds produced by this kind of intense star formation, these hot diffuse sort of like wakes of gas travel outwards from the galactic center, and as they travel, they pick up cold gas clouds and they become sort of entrained, and they travel out along with these. And so, people have been trying to model these, just trying to get the kinematics of these right, because that could potentially constrain star formation and give important information about how to inform feedback in galaxy formations. And so one of the potential concerns is that, okay, so if we have a cold gas cloud entrained in hot diffuse gas, do we have to worry about this cloud? Because our non-equilibrium condition relies on the fact that these are stable on a long time scale. And so some of the concerns were that, okay, so if we have this sitting in hot gas, is this going to break down our gas cloud? And so some of the very early work on this topic from 1994 kind of established some of the critical time scales, and they considered some of the critical processes that break down clouds. So you have various hydrodynamic instabilities, you have evaporation, and so on and so forth. And all of these processes have different time scales associated with them. So if we look at our particular case and we just apply this very kind of theoretical old model to our clouds, we sit right on the cusp of when you would expect potentially to see some of these effects. But luckily for us, in the meantime, people have sort of taken closer looks at these kind of calculations and have done more higher resolved simulations and have done more realistic simulations which incorporate magnetic fields. And so if you kind of run these more detailed calculations, you find that on the timescales that we are observing things, these objects do remain stable, and they remain retain their structural integrity. And what's really critical to these is the internal magnetic fields by the looks of it, as well as getting the correct resolution in the simulation. So it's an ongoing area of research, but from what we can tell, the latest simulation suggests that we can treat these objects as stable. Yeah.
The other thing I want to ask, have you guys thought about the production mechanism for the vector portal modules? If you try to put the production mechanism like freezing or something, or I don't know what that can be, or even thermal production mechanism, does that, how much does that constrain the parameter space?
You haven't looked into that in detail, but I think for some models,
yeah,
we're in thermal friction space, but yeah, good example.
Yeah.
That was it.
All right. All right. Thanks again.
Mm-hmm. That sounds solid.